this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Brett Kelly, Alex Bible, and Andrea Sylvia, all graduate students at Iowa State University studying a variety of species and topics. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at FisheriesPod, or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. I was recently invited back to my alma mater, Iowa State, to talk to the AFS student subunit there. While I was in Ames, I was fortunate enough to be able to talk to a handful of graduate students working on a bunch of cool projects. The first one we'll hear from is Brett Kelly. Brett is a master's student at Iowa State University, pursuing a degree in fisheries biology. He received his bachelor's degree in wildlife and fisheries biology from Clemson University in 2017. During his time there, he participated in undergraduate research involving stream fish ecology and stream restoration. His current research involves investigating environmental parameters associated with the spatial distribution of fish in headwater streams of Iowa's driftless area, with special interest in locating wild populations of Iowa's only native trout, the brook trout. Welcome to the podcast, Brett.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on.
So when a lot of people think of Iowa, they think of flat cornfields, and I'm guessing because you went to Clemson, you're from South Carolina?
Yeah, I am. I grew up there.
So what did you think when you first saw the position announcement for your project?
So I'll be 100% honest. When I saw it on the AFS job board, I read it, and it said driftless area, and I immediately thought of, because I'm a fisherman, drift and fly fishing, I was like, is it something about hydrology? Like, is it something weird about the water? So I honestly didn't know anything about how unique of an ecoregion it was. But I was actually sitting in the DNR office at the time, and I sort of talked to one of the other biologists that I worked for at the time, Kevin Kubach, for South Carolina DNR. And he said, no, that's a really cool place you need to look up. And so I started researching more about what the driftless area is and had, you know, limestone geology and all these bluffs and cold water streams, and I was like, oh wow, you know, started looking at some Google images, and I was like, wow, Iowa seems like pretty, you know, interesting place. It's definitely more than what you hear about just like an agricultural landscape. So I was excited to get out and about. I grew up in South Carolina, lived there for, you know, my first 22 years, and I had never lived anywhere else for any extended period of time, so I was sort of excited to maybe see another part of the country.
So you described a kind of unique part of Iowa, and I'd imagine with a pretty unique landscape to Iowa that's got fairly unique fish populations compared to the rest of Iowa. What kind of fish do you see in those driftless streams in that part of the state?
Yeah, so the driftless area has sort of a wealth of groundwater resources, and so it gives rise to a lot of cold water streams that you probably typically wouldn't find anywhere else in the state. So you have a couple species like mottled sculpin, slimy sculpin, and, you know, one that I have particular interest in, which is the brook trout. All those are native to northeastern Iowa, and then it currently still has populations of brown and rainbow trout, you know, mostly from stocking efforts, but cold water species you would not find in any other part of the state.
Your master's work is investigating the environmental parameters associated with spatial distribution of fish in that part of the world. I guess, what are some of the environmental parameters that these fish in the driftless area are seeing?
Oh, okay, yeah, so the habitat characterization we do is all mainly in stream. So we look at, you know, what type of substrates and sort of how much of our, you know, transects that we do are composed of cobbles, sands, silt, boulders and things like that. And then we look at water temperature, obviously, because we're talking about cold water fish. In stream cover, so things like undercut banks and, you know, large woody debris. So it's sort of a whole host of things there, and that's like a standardized habitat protocol that was handed down by the state of Iowa. And in our results so far, they're somewhat preliminary because we only had our first field season, but for brook trout anyway, it seems like the habitat factors that are most important for them are water temperature, which is sort of not a surprise being that they're a, you know, stenothermal cold water species. I don't like to get into warmer parts of the stream. Pool habitats, so like slow moving habitats, glides and pools. Cobble substrate or just rock substrate in general, you know, sites that have a higher percentage of those larger substrates, they tend to be in those sites more, and things like that. For brown trout, there aren't a lot of things that we found, but one thing that is a recurring theme is there's like a bear bank severity index that we look at. So it's just a measurement of how much it's sort of like a proxy for erosion in the riparian area. So it's like how much bare soil do you see in the stream bank? That seems to be something that, you know, for multiple species, as that index gets higher and higher, so less stable banks, certain fish that are sensitive to that kind of thing tend to, you know, fall out of our samples. So
a lot of these trout streams are stocked by Iowa's hatchery system. And I guess if it wasn't for these stocking programs, would many of these fish populations be able to sustain themselves?
So that's a good question. So all of our study sites, for the most part, are on privately owned land that has either never been stocked or obviously currently is not stocked. So when I was looking at study design, we originally it was branded as, you know, trying to find remnant populations of brook trout, which I'm not doing the genetic piece of the project. Dr. Wes Larson at UW Stevens Point is looking at the genetic side of the project. So for my results, I knew that I had to maybe talk more about wild trout instead of like genetically unique to Iowa trout populations. So I tried to make sure I stratified sample selection by, you know, distance away from stocked portions of streams. And one thing that we did is that we worked with hatchery staff. So I didn't sample any upper reaches of watersheds after they stocked in 2018. So essentially, they made sure that if they were going to stock catchable size brook trout, they did it in watersheds after we did our sampling in the headwaters. And they actually did not stock any brown trout fingerlings for that entire year for my study area. And what we're seeing is that it sort of varies by species, but brown trout specifically are, you know, they have very sort of like a prolific range expansion in northeastern Iowa. And there's a lot of places that have natural reproduction of brown trout. Brook trout are lagging behind by a, you know, a significant piece, but we did find a couple sites where we sampled either young of the year or juvenile brook trout. So that's a good indication, you know, that, you know, they didn't stock that year. They don't stock juvenile brook trout anyway. So, you know, there are a couple populations of brook trout that are, you know, have some recruitment. As far as rainbow trout goes, I cannot think of any natural reproduction of rainbow trout or any, you know, self-sustaining populations in the area.
You mentioned that you just did 1 year of field work so far. Do you have anything that you're going to do differently in your second summer of field work?
So I think the protocol remained the same for the most part. The only thing different essentially is that we'll sample different sites. So in an effort to try and sample more streams and cover a larger geographic area, we're just doing one site visit per, you know, the duration of the project. We have stream temperature monitors in all of our places, so I'll go back just to look at stream temperature data, but we only sample, as far as like fish assemblage goes, one time. So the only thing different about year two is just new places. So we'll, you know, we'll sample sites that we haven't sampled yet.
And Brett was nice enough to rope one of his fellow lab mates in, so our next guest we'll hear from is Alex Bible. Alex has been interested in fishes and fishing since being a young child, growing up and fishing the Schuylkill River in Pennsylvania with his father. This led to an interest in fisheries and stream ecology that today is narrowed down to imperiled stream fishes and the restoration and recovery efforts associated with them. Alex received a bachelor's degree in fisheries biology from Mansfield University in 2015. After that, he worked as a stream and lake habitat technician on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Alaska. Alex then came to Iowa State University and successfully defended his master's thesis on the endangered Topeka shiner this past December and has just accepted a job as a fisheries biologist with the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon, where he will be a project lead for their Chinook and summer steelhead projects. Welcome to the podcast, Alex.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So, Alex, I currently live very close to Topeka, but I've never seen a Topeka shiner before. Would you mind describing the Topeka shiner?
Yeah, so that's not a common thing for people in Kansas, people in Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota. So it's a Midwestern fish. It's an endangered species, one of the few endangered cyprinids that we have in the Midwest. So again, small minnow species, maybe gets up to 3 inches or so. Silvery. The males, so that's kind of the big selling point of the Topeka shiner. The males get bright orange fins and breeding colors, caudal, dorsal, all of them. They also get this kind of like purple, green kind of tinge on their dorsal side. Very pretty fish. Topeka shiners are a prairie fish species. They're in small headwater streams. Unique about them is, so they like off-channel habitats, so oxbow, which in the Midwest has been really replaced by channelization. So stream channelization, they come in straight in the stream. All that natural meandering process kind of stops and you lose inundation of your oxbows or they just aren't created. So really that habitat that Topeka shiners thrive in is kind of gone. So that's why you see them as endangered now. We just have a lot fewer populations than there used to be.
So you mentioned that most people don't know about them, and I guess I've always been more interested in the more charismatic fishes or sport fishes. So I guess what got you interested in doing a master's degree on Topeka shiner?
Yeah, so that's kind of the thing that everyone, you know, is drawn to, the more charismatic thing. So, you know, before I was in Iowa State, I worked in Alaska with salmon. So obviously that's what people kind of want to do. Really just it intrigued me. So endangered species to me is something that I find kind of intriguing. So, you know, species in decline, and the Topeka in general, it's, I guess, to me is interesting because it wasn't so charismatic. So people don't really know about it. And to me, that's something that I think those fish, you know, people need to research those too. And again, like working with fish that not many people knows about, it's kind of a point of pride for me. You know, not many people know about it, so not many people get to see them.
So then when you go out and do your sampling, how is it that you collect your fish?
So we do a couple of different methods. So in streams, we'll do an electrofishing pass. These are headwater streams, so generally backpacker electrofishing or barge electrofishing, which is somewhat effective. You know, you'll get some fish, but, you know, number-wise, you might not get as many. And I'm particularly doing a genetic study, so you need more samples. So we'll also follow it up with a seine pass, so as many as we can get in a single stretch, you know. Streams are rocky, there's trees, you know, you have to deal with all that sort of thing, so that can be difficult too. And we also sample off-channel habitat oxbows, which are a lot easier because you can just take a bag seine. We have a big 55-foot seine that we just pull right through these things, and you can get, you know, potentially thousands of fish in one pool, which is, well, a lot of fish. It's hard to sort through, but definitely a lot more effective.
So you mentioned you're collecting some genetic information. I guess my next question was, after you collect all your Topeka shiner, what kind of information are you looking for?
Yeah, so my genetic study was mainly focused on microsatellite genetic data. So what we're doing with that is we have 9 different loci that we're looking at, and we're comparing Topeka shiners, so kind of at 2 different levels. The first is a range-wide study, so collecting Topeka shiners from the 6 states that they're found in, so South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. I think that was 6. But anyways, and then comparing, so genetic diversity, what's, you know, low genetic diversity is obviously bad for a species. You know, they're less able to adapt to change, things like that. So given that it's an endangered species, you want to know that. But then also, you know, how related are these fish to each other? So that's a large geographic area that is talked about, but there's only relatively few populations. So generally, a couple different watersheds per state they're in. So really we wanted to know how many populations we had. And currently my research kind of shows we're sitting at about 8 or so, potentially more depending on sampling. You know, we got to about as many as we could, but there's always a chance for more. And then, so the second chapter of my thesis, other part of my research, is a bit more interesting. So in Iowa and Minnesota, we looked at within basin metapopulation dynamics. So essentially we go in, sample both streams and oxbows kind of throughout the basin. You know, it's endangered species. You do the best you can with distribution. But really what we're looking for is how connected are these fish? So the idea is, you know, because this is a fragmented species, they only occur in little, you know, separate parts of the drainage. We don't think it's a continuous distribution. Are they completely isolated little populations, you know, existing on the landscape? Are they, is there kind of this integration? Are they moving throughout the basin? Or are they kind of existing in little fragmented populations with relatively little flow, which is kind of your metapopulation? And what we ended up finding there was we did have that. So we had populations that would say one stream or one part of the stream, there'd be, you know, a couple of sites where we'd find Topeka shiners, and that would kind of consist of a single population or, you know, metapopulation, subpopulation. And we'd have little one kind of subpopulation in one part of the stream, and then another subpopulation in another part of the stream, and there'd be migration between them. And then in particular, so you have those, and then source sink dynamics, so which subpopulation, some of them are exporting fish, so those would be your sources. And then harder to find is sinks, which would be the ones that are kind of importing fish and not exporting. And those were kind of harder to find, and we couldn't really find any subpopulations that were sinks. We only found a couple sources.
So based off of your research, what does the future look like for Topeka shiner in Iowa?
So the future in Topeka shiner in Iowa is kind of interesting. So before this study, so I should mention that I kind of did my study in kind of conjunction with a couple other grad students, Nick Simpson and Courtney Zambori, who they've looked at different parts. So Nick did fish habitat and fish habitat and fish assemblage relationships, and then Courtney did more of a GIS analysis of oxbow restorations and also species distribution modeling. But when we went out and sampled in Iowa, we knew that Topeka shiners occurred in one drainage, which was the North Raccoon, and then partly in another drainage, which was the Rock, which is up near the Minnesota border. But a big question mark was whether or not the Boone River drainage had any fish. Nick was supposed to go sample it, and we didn't think, you know, based on talks with Fish and Wildlife and, you know, Iowa DNR and other university people, that there was even Topeka shiners in the Boone. And when we went and sampled them, we actually found that that was one of the more abundant places they were. So three drainages is not a lot. It's definitely not what it used to be, but it's a little bit brighter than it was a couple years ago. Right now, the populations appear to be holding steady. Again, human development, things like that, those are always a threat, you know, channelization. We're getting better land practices, so hopefully the populations stay, you know, up. Restoration, so U.S. Fish and Wildlife is coming in, digging the off-channel habitats down to groundwater, so it allows kind of fish to hold over in these times of low flow, so they'll come in floods, and then the stream will become disconnected from the oxbows, and they'll kind of hold, and that kind of allows them to kind of this refuge from predators, things like that. It's, you know, preferred habitat. They like slow-moving water, and then they can kind of repopulate the stream during a flooding event. So those, you know, seem to be working. Kind of the studies that Fish and Wildlife have done show that they seem to be using these oxbows and are showing up in greater numbers than we're even seeing in the stream. So, yeah, it's an endangered species, but there's definitely some reason for optimism with the Topeka shiners.
And you recently defended your thesis, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you as you start your new job. When do you start?
Yeah, so it looks like at this point I'm going to be starting in about a month here. So early April, I'm going to be working for the Warm Springs Tribes in Oregon, working for their steelhead and Chinook salmon project. So essentially, the Warm Springs Reservation is on land that feeds the Deschutes River, so the tributaries there run into the Deschutes, and the salmon, the Chinook salmon and the steelhead have actually been in decline since about 2000. They have a hatchery there, and they're seeing kind of reduction in numbers and escapement, and also just number of reds or reproductions down as well. So kind of my job will be in the future to go in and kind of monitor this and, you know, help the recovery of these salmon. So I'm excited to start that here pretty soon.
And last but not least, we have the wisest of the bunch, Andrea Sylvia. Andrea received her undergraduate degree in life sciences from Arizona State University and her master's degree in marine estuarian and environmental sciences from the University of Maryland Chesapeake Biological Laboratory. She is currently at Iowa State University, where she is a fourth-year PhD candidate working towards a degree in fish biology. Her research interests focus around understanding human-induced impacts on fish and fisheries population dynamics, and is currently studying the effects of live-release tournament angling on largemouth bass populations from a large-scale marker capture study on an Iowa reservoir. Welcome to the podcast, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
Arizona to Maryland to Iowa, that is quite a range of climates and ecosystems. Having lived in all those places, do you have one that you prefer?
I think I'm definitely fond of the warmer weather. So any state where it doesn't snow 12 inches every winter and stays above about 50 degrees. So,
so not this winter in Iowa.
Yes, not this winter in Iowa.
All right, and your degree from Maryland sounds like you worked a lot more in the saltwater realm. I guess, what brought you back to the good side of studying freshwater fish?
Yeah, so I started my time in fisheries in Arizona. I worked for the Game and Fish out there, and I also did some undergraduate research on bass populations in Arizona. Then I had the opportunity to go to Maryland, and I studied commercial fishing regulations there. I decided to come back into freshwater in that because being in Maryland, being in the commercial fishery side of things, I was really excited about all the different quantitative tools that scientists use over there. And I thought it would just be really cool to find a good project for my PhD where I could actually use everything that I learned on that quantitative side of things and apply that to freshwater fisheries issues. So this program that I'm in now, the study that I work on, really worked out well for that.
So your dissertation, as I mentioned, is focusing on understanding human-induced impacts on fish. I guess, what are some of those impacts?
Yeah, so what I primarily focus on is I study largemouth bass populations in Iowa. We're looking at a specific reservoir kind of as our study site. And we're looking at the effects of tournament angling on largemouth bass populations. So how do we really manage for those tournaments and what kind of potential population effects does that tournament angling have on the bass in that system? So we started a large marker capture program in 2015. That is actually still going on. We recently have a master student taking over that program, so that'll go on for another 2 years as well. And really using that marker capture data to understand what's going on with mortality, survival of fish in these lakes.
So, and Iowa is viewed as a largely rural state, so I guess how large are some of these human impacts really affecting some of these fishes?
Something interesting we found, so the funny thing is, which really surprised me when I got to Iowa, is, you know, coming from the Southwest, it being even the South, you think of these fishing tournaments, these huge, massive fishing tournaments on these giant reservoirs, but you don't really think that that's something that's going on in Iowa. The lake we study actually sees approximately 45 largemouth bass tournaments every year during the open water season. So that's sometimes gets up to about 3 fishing tournaments on that system a week. So the impacts can be a lot larger than you would expect, especially up here in the Midwest in a really a more rural area. We actually have designed a marker capture model that allows us to understand total mortality of tournament angling. So that includes initial mortality and then also delayed mortality, which is what a lot of scientists refer to as the cryptic mortality, which occurs after a fish is released. So we were really able to harness this marker capture study to answer this broader question of really what's happening within that system. And kind of some of the things we found is that the mortality, depending on weather and number of times a fish has been captured at a tournament, can be up to 30% within that tournament. So it's a lot higher than some of the other estimates that we've seen in these similar regions throughout the United States.
Well, your study site sees as many as 3 tournaments a week. You do a lot of your work on Brushy Creek Reservoir, correct?
Yes.
I guess, could you tell us a little bit about Brushy Creek and the size of it that sees that much tournament pressure?
Yeah, so Brushy Creek is a 690-acre reservoir. It's relatively new. It was dammed in 1998, I believe. So we call it the destroyer of our fish sampling boat because it's just covered in trees. But that also means there's a ton of habitat for fish out there. Lots of bass. It, on top of having a lot of tournament pressure, it also sees a lot of catch and release, recreational angling pressure as well. So not a huge lake compared to, you know, if you think about some of the other systems that large tournaments occur on, not a huge one, but a pretty healthy bass population.
So you mentioned a marker capture program that you work on, but I think from seeing one of your earlier talks, you also implant some of these fish with radio transmitters.
Yeah, so we actually implanted 50 largemouth bass with radio transmitters. So we go out every week and track these fish, trying to get a better idea of both habitat selection in these bass, as well as using this as another method to understand mortality and what kind of fish are coming into the tournaments. And then one of the really interesting things we're planning on doing is on top of putting these radio transmitters out, we also decided that we wanted to track anglers as well. So this last summer, we actually gave GPS units to tournament anglers. And the plan moving forward is to really match up those, both the tournament anglers' movements and the fish movements, and look at relationships between them. So kind of better understand that connectivity between the fish and the angler.
If I remember correctly, you had some interesting locations that some of your transmitters turned back up.
Yes, we did. So probably our most interesting location is we actually have a resident eagle's nest at Brushy Creek, and two of our tags over two summers ended up in those nests. And this was confirmed because this eagle nest blew down in a storm, and we were able to retrieve both of our tags. So we stopped referring to our fish as the as its tag number, and it was just the eagle's nest bass. But yeah, we've had really interesting findings. We've found a lot of tags just 100 yards up away from the lake, so most likely predation from other animals. So yeah, you really find some interesting things. In fact, we another study that's going on at Brushy Creek has also tags muskie and walleye, and that graduate student found three tags in a snake, actually. So so there's some easy targets out there, apparently.
Yeah, so it's not just the bass anglers you have to watch out for.
Exactly, yep. There's definitely other sources of mortality on the lake.
All right, Brett, Alex, and Andrea, thank you for telling us all about a little bit about your projects. But now we'll move on to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish? I guess we'll just work our way around.
Sure. So I'm going to give you an unconventional answer, but my favorite fish is the bluehead chub. And the reason why is that my first fishery-specific technician job involved working with a couple other undergraduates and a graduate student, and we went out and we did spawning surveys for bluehead chub. So we would go out and we would locate bluehead chub mounds, and then we would observe if there was any yellowfin shiner spawning activity on those mounds, and then if there was any bluehead chubs actually actively building the mound or spawning on the mound while we were doing our work. So it was the first job that got me into fisheries, and so I have to owe a lot of, you know, where I am now to the grad student that I worked for and the lab that I worked in, so that is my favorite fish. It's also remarkable at some of the mounds they can build with moving pebbles one by one with their mouth, like 3 feet wide. So they're incredible. They're awesome fish.
Andrea, what is your favorite fish?
All right, these guys are going to laugh at me, but I'm going to go with the bluegill. Because I'm a very poor angler. So, you know, I go out on the lake and I'm like, I'm going to catch a 18-inch bass today. And after 2 hours of not catching anything, just, you know, throw a worm in the water. And the bluegill always comes through. So.
Not a bad answer. No, I think that's a great answer.
We've had a couple different guests say their favorite bluegill.
That's so true, yeah.
My best fishing memories are with them.
Yeah. All right, Alex, what about you?
So this is actually a really hard question for me. I've been asked this during, like, a job interview before, and I know some of our technicians, we've asked that. So I've thought about this for 3 years, and I'm still working on my answer. So Arctic grayling, I think. So when I was up in Alaska, I got the fish for them, and they're just super cool. They're like, they look like little like freshwater sailfish, and they're colorful, and then they live in the Arctic, which is fun. But yeah, it's just, I'm going with Arctic grayling. That's my favorite one to fish for, so I'm going to use that criteria and say Arctic grayling.
All right, we'll stay with you. What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
So, yeah, so my favorite memory, I have, like, one individual memory that probably was the kind of the my kind of proudest moment in fisheries. So we were sampling for Topeka Shiners on this project here at Iowa State, and we were on a stream that we just... historically, there had been Topeka Shiners, but we had done a couple sites for the study, and we couldn't find them anywhere. We couldn't find them. And we had one last site of the summer, my last field season. I said, okay, this is our last chance. And we electrofished through it, didn't get anything. We're sanding up through, and we saw this one little kind of side channel that was this slack water, which is perfect Topeka Shiner habitat. And me and my tech looked at each other and we said, if we're going to find a Topeka Shiner on this stream, it's going to be in that pool. And we seined through it, and we pulled it up, and sure enough, we saw that little red fin that shows us the Topeka Shiner, and then we found a female, so a reproducing pair, hopefully. So we were able to call that, you know, successfully found Topeka Shiners on that stream, so they didn't decline, so I was super pumped about that, and for whatever reason, that stuck with me.
All right, Andrea, how about you?
All right, so as much as I love field work, I would probably say the most memorable time in my time in fisheries is really once all the field work is done and you get to sit down and see what really create something from all the data you collected and kind of start to see results and start to get answers. So that's definitely kind of the best times for me, I think.
Brett, how about you?
So I am similar to Alex in my response. So yeah, like I mentioned earlier, not being from here and not even knowing what the Driftless area was at the time, just being able to be like fully immersed in it and drive around and see all the bluffs and the cold water streams was cool. But there was one day in particular where it was towards the later part of the summer, and we were sort of trying to find brook trout sites at that point. You know, we were sort of striking out at a lot of places in the earlier part of the summer and getting a little discouraged. But there was one day when we went to a private landowner's property that had about 10 different springs on it. You know, it was really nice cobble bottom and really cold water. And you're just going through this tiny stream that was less than a meter wide. And then, you know, we were almost to the end of our transect and about to pack it in for the day, and it was starting to rain. And we come upon, like, this big pool. And so we had not sampled any brook trout up to that point, and it was about 150 meters or so sampled thus far. And then we get into that pool, and I sink right up about to my wader's limit and, you know, in the pool. And all of a sudden, we sample 5 adult brook trout all over 10 inches. And that was just, that was one of the coolest days of the summer, you know, a small stream. You know, and being able to find 5 adults like that, you know, for other places throughout the country, that's nothing. But for some of these really small headwater streams and the study system I'm in, that was an awesome experience.
All right, we'll stick with you and go back around. Yes. Brett, what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
So this is probably, I know Alex had a tough time with the last one, but this is probably one of the hardest ones for me. I want to work in stream systems in some capacity, and because I just love native stream fish, whether it's salmonids or, like I said, my favorite fish is bluehead chub, which is definitely not a game fish. But so definitely doing something like that, whether it's management or restoration. But I guess I would be remiss if I didn't say that since 8th grade, I've wanted to work for Trout Unlimited. So they just do some really cool work, and I think that they have, you know, a lot of different opportunities to work with anglers and scientists, and they you know, they produce some really cool stuff, and I've met some people that work for them that are, you know, people that I look up to. So, and maybe one day it'd be cool to work for them.
All right, Andrew, how about you?
I've actually had the opportunity as a PhD student to do some teaching while I was here, so I think my dream job would probably be a professor at a university, getting to teach students coming in about how wonderful fisheries is and all the different opportunities that you really get in this field. So, and somewhere warm.
How about you, Alex? Do you have a dream job or dream location?
Yeah, so actually kind of a plug for myself, I actually am about to start my dream job. So working with Salmonid in the Pacific Northwest was something I always wanted to do, really, since kind of undergrad, starting to learn about fisheries. I was always like, I want to go there. And, you know, now that I'm going to go to Central Oregon, I get the chance to experience that. So I'm super pumped about that.
You just finished your master's project and getting out of the world of research a little bit, but if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
So kind of because I work with these kind of cryptic, rare, and endangered species with my master's, the one thing that I would love to do is just get an inventory of kind of species. You know, if money isn't an object, we're going big here. So if you could just, really, I think that's a big thing for some of these species. We just don't know, you know, some of their distributions, you know, where they all are. And that can be hard for management decisions. So really, if you could kind of just inventory these species and get to monitor them, sometimes that's really all it takes. Is the first step is just, you know, knowing where fish are. So I think it would take a lot of money, which isn't an object, but it would also take a lot of people. So hopefully I have unlimited people too. But if we could get out there and just sample everywhere and get an inventory of what we have, I think that would be a good starting point to really kind of bolster other projects.
All right, Andrea, hopefully Alex didn't steal your idea.
No, I don't know. No, I think if I had unlimited money, you know, being someone who's kind of a data cruncher, I think there's a lot of agencies and universities and just a lot of places everywhere where there's a lot of data that no one can really, maybe doesn't have the time, doesn't have the funding to get to. So I would love to just go around and say, hey, what questions do you have? What old data do you have that you never were able to look at? Just take a tour of all the so really kind of just digging into some questions we were never really able to answer. I don't know, you know, there's probably so much information out there, you don't necessarily need to go out and collect more data. You can kind of use what you have and just kind of build on that. So that would be something I would be interested in doing.
All right, Brett, how about you?
You know, through the project, I've definitely gained a true affection for brook trout in Iowa. So if money were no object, I'd love to work on a much larger scale with private landowners to do, just large scale restoration, not only for habitat, but for reintroductions of here in Iowa, we have a native strain of brook trout that they raise in the hatchery that is collected from South Pine Creek. So I'd love to do just like large scale reintroductions and habitat restoration for the fish. And the Iowa DNR is doing this to a certain degree, but it's really tough to, one, sort of identify places where, you know, you can reintroduce the fish on privately owned land. And then two, a lot of times reintroduction isn't always partnered with habitat restoration. So it'd be nice to do both of those things on a really large scale and see a big upsurgence of native brook trout in Iowa. You know, that would be awesome.
Right, and then the final and probably the hardest of the easy questions is, if there is one point or one principle that you get programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
So people in the department probably think I'm very annoying for probably spearheading this all the time, but I really do think that, you know, sustainability matters, and you know, we're really good as conservationists at managing fisheries populations to a certain, you know, for by and large, and we're good at, you know, sort of collecting data on, you know, stock assessments, things like that. But one thing I wish we did a little bit more of was take personal steps, or even steps within agencies, to sort of address the anthropogenic causes of some of these fisheries declines and sort of take sustainability to a better level, you know. And that's something that if scientists can get behind, then sometimes the general public will sort of lag behind as well. So that's I get on my soapbox a lot about that, so people probably get annoyed. But that's one I think is actually really important going forward.
And Andrew, how about you? Do you have one point or one principle?
I think mine is just for people to really find something that they love what they're doing, you know, especially seeing students come through the university. Just find a job you love doing. You know, the saying is, if you find a job you love, you'll never work a day in your life. I work a few days in my life, but overall, I'm excited to come to work every day. I've been lucky enough to find a career that I love, and I think if other people could really, you know, take that message to heart, you'd have a lot of really happy people out there in the world, so...
Your last one up?
I would just say that just, you know, in terms of for this, you know, in science, just get out there and go discover things, you know, with this project. You know, you got to get out there and sample. And, you know, you think you know what you're going to find, but you don't always don't. And I think that's where you're kind of, everyone's pushing the, you know, the edge of science is really just going out there and, you know, finding new things and just getting out there and trying new things. So.
All right, well. Thank you all for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and the work you're doing at my alma mater, Iowa State University. But if people want to find out more information or get a hold of you or Andrea, send you flash drives full of data, what would be the best way to do that?
Oh, well, yeah, I guess I'll start. But you can always follow me on Twitter at BBK_95. I'm with a lot of other fishery scientists, sort of active on there and try and keep it pretty professional. So you won't get any embarrassing lifestyle photos. It's mostly fish. So, yeah, or an email at bbkelly@iastate.edu if you're interested in the project or some of the work that we're doing.
Yeah, I'm not as hip as Brett here, but I can always be reached by my email at asylvia@iastate.edu. Yeah, and we're always, always welcome to chat about the project, take questions, send me data, whatever you guys want to do.
Yeah, I guess I don't really have an Iowa State email soon because I'm leaving, but you can always reach me at BibleAP@gmail.com. That's BYBEL@gmail.com.
If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at Facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@TheFisheriesPodcast.com.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify, TuneIn, or TheFisheriesPodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 29th episode of The Fisheries Podcast. And remember, practice sustainability, try new things, and find something you love.